next case is 001963, Mary R. Parrish versus Royce L. Parrish. Ms. Hine.
Good morning. I'm Catherine Hine, representing the appellant Mary Parrish in the civil protection order proceeding from Ross County, Ohio. The case below presents this court with an opportunity to clarify for all of the lower courts of Ohio and all of the courts of appeals that victims of domestic violence don't necessarily have to wait until they are physically injured before they can obtain the protections of 3113.31.
Do you read this opinion to say if this gentleman had molested a daughter of another marriage rather than alleged abuse of the son, that evidence could not have come in to protect the daughter's current name?
Do I read the Court of Appeals opinion as saying that would not have come in? I don't think that they even discussed significantly the sibling abuse issue. They did mention Scheuermann, in which there was physical abuse of one sibling, and there was a nexus to creating a dependency in the other sibling. There are cases from other jurisdictions that I list in my brief that specifically address the issue of sexual abuse of a daughter presents a risk of abuse to sons. And so I believe that there is such a risk. Had that been the case, I don't really understand what the Court of Appeals' position on that might have been. I don't really understand how they dealt with Scheuermann and how they distinguished Scheuermann exactly from what occurred to the child BJ in this case, and how that presented a risk of harm to the two younger children of the marriage of the perpetrator with my client.
I'm just trying to figure out where the Supreme Court, or where that court, would draw the line as to how bad or how frequent or what type of abuse it was before you could bring it in.
I think, of course, these cases are particularly susceptible to a case-by-case interpretation. However, I think when you have got multiple incidents of violence, whether it's violence to objects, hurling objects, breaking down doors, bashing in car windows into an occupied vehicle, and you have not one but three incidents of abuse to a small child, you've crossed the line. And every victim intuitively knows that they are at risk. I think it's important for the court to reiterate the position it took in Felton, where the legislative intent of domestic violence to be treated differently than simple assault. And that part of the rationale, I believe, is there's a power differential in domestic violence that you don't see in a simple assault, a barroom type fight. We're dealing in civil protection order proceedings with persons of unequal strength and authority and power perpetrating against younger, more vulnerable individuals.
Counsel, I have a procedural problem with this case and a jurisdictional problem. You want us to reinstate an ex parte order in a dismissed common pleas case. How do we do that?
That's one possibility. Another possibility is simply to remand to the trial court to take proper consideration of the factors that the trial court stated it could not take into account because of its confusion of the evidence that bore on the custody issues and its feeling that it had to disregard the relevance that that very same evidence had.
Your brief says the decision of the Court of Appeals should be reversed in the provisions of the earlier, on page 29, of the earlier ex parte civil protection order reinstated. I don't know how I would have any authority to reinstate an ex parte order in a case that's no longer existing.
Our position, of course, is that the civil protection order was improperly dismissed. So if this court reversed the dismissal, then that would reinstate the petition, and I believe that the court would have authority to determine that the uncontroverted facts of record do establish the risk of domestic violence.
Yes, I was looking to see whether you're just trying to establish a principle of law or whether there anything comes out of this case. If, I mean, it's been, what, 3 years now. You still want a civil protection order against this defendant?
Yes, Your Honor. Obviously, it would have been better had we been granted it the first time.
Yeah, obviously, because I don't know what we have to act on. That's my problem.
Well, it was the same basic problem, I believe, with Felton versus Felton, that the that on the hearing on the full civil protection order, the petition was dismissed. And again, there was uncontroverted evidence. I would like, the purpose of going this far, of course, is for this court to establish some guidelines and some caveats for the lower courts as far as, again, instructing courts that the remedies provided by the civil protection order statute are not in lieu of. They are in addition to remedies provided under other statutes, in particular Rule 75. It's important for this court to discount the pretexts that have been used by the trial court and the Court of Appeals, particularly the red herring of the custody issue, that is not a valid reason to not consider the granting of a civil protection order any more than the court in Thomas versus Thomas was authorized to discount the need for a civil protection order because, after all, there was a temporary restraining order in place. That should have been good enough. Well, maybe it would have been, maybe it wouldn't have been.
In this case, I understand the procedural history, the trial court dismissed, originally granted the ex parte protection order, correct?
It originally granted the emergency order, yes.
And it dismissed it
after hearing.
After hearing. You appealed, or whoever it was, the trial court appealed the dismissal.
Yes.
The court appealed, sat on the case for 21 months, and then issued an order affirming the dismissal.
Correct.
And you seek a reversal of the dismissal.
Yes. And a reversal of the affirmance by the Court of Appeals.
Do you know why the Court of Appeals took 21 months to decide a...
I have no idea.
...a party order, which is generally considered of emergency nature?
I have no idea. But I won't say that I won't have any idea. I think it's important in understanding why lower courts do what they do in domestic violence litigation, whether it's of the civil variety. It tends to be more that they do this in the civil context rather than the criminal context, paradoxically. And I would refer to Harvard's professor Judith Herman in her book, Trauma and Recovery. She describes the difficulty that we as a society have in truly feeling empathy for victims of violence. She says, it's very tempting to take the side of the perpetrator. All the perpetrator asks is that the bystander do nothing. He appeals to the universal desire to see, hear, and speak no evil. The victim, on the contrary, asks the bystander to share the burden of pain. The victim demands action, engagement, and remembering. And this kind of thinking, I submit, contaminates judicial interpretation of domestic violence statutes and repeatedly results in piecemeal interpretations of evidence, a refusal to look at totality of the circumstances, a refusal to consider the factors and the definition of domestic violence that's given in A1, A, B, and C in a context, together, as a whole. When you don't do that, when courts fail to do that, they are not truly looking at the victim's circumstance in the context in which domestic violence occurs.
I'm still trying to figure out what law we're going to write in this case. Over here.
This is Douglas.
I'm still trying to figure out what law we're going to write in this case. If any, would it be fair to say that what you seek is a syllabus to the effect that if one can show subjective fear, or if one can show immediate and present danger, that triggers the protections of 3113.31 RE-A protection order? Would that do it? Because each one of your propositions of law involves certain facts, as opposed to a rule of law that we have to establish.
Basically, it would be a paraphrase of Section D of the statute that what does immediate and present danger of domestic violence consist of. The statute itself says that it includes but is not limited to situations in which the respondent has threatened the family or household member with bodily harm.
And that's a factual matter.
That's a factual matter, but I think...
by a trial court, generally.
That's true, except when trial courts and courts of appeals are taking very narrow interpretations of the wording of that statute, and they are saying, as they have in this case, that threats must be verbal, and they must be specific, and I suppose they must conform to all the elements of what a threat is as what we think of as a threat, that threats cannot happen by conduct. This court has never come out and said threats by conduct actually can be far more ominous than are threats by verbalization. And I think the courts are really confused on that.
Well, it appears that this trial judge was even confused as to the standard of proof, where he talked about it hasn't been established by clear and convincing evidence or even by the respondent, so it appears that he didn't even know what standard he was to follow.
Right. And disturbingly, the Court of Appeals stated that there's nothing in the record that would suggest that the trial court did not know what the standard of proof was. Disturbingly, the Fourth District repeatedly omitted significant chunks of the record. For example, the admission that was testified to by the alleged perpetrator that he intended to do whatever he wanted to do to his children. And that included, this was right after an incident of physical violence. That establishes the nexus between the act of abuse on BJ and the threat that existed toward the other family members. And that was completely, it wasn't just ignored by the Fourth District, it was said, well, it was ignored. And there were other distortions of the record that I set forth in my brief.
I guess I'd have to belabor the point. I had the same question Justice Douglas just asked you, and I thought what you were asking is, it's not in the proposition of law expressly, but you're asking us to essentially say that it would be an abuse of discretion for a trial court to not admit evidence regarding the abuse of a child who is not the child in the case before the trial court, or something such as that. Isn't that what you're asking? That
if the child in question has been severely beaten to a point of visible injury, and that child is the child of the respondent,
right,
his own biological child, or a household member, or both, then yes, I think it is error to exclude that, because then you cannot establish the totality of the circumstances, and you've done a great disservice to the victim of domestic violence, who is also, remember, this case is in the context of a divorce, where this court has previously noted the great danger in which women seeking marital termination are placed when there has been pre-existing reasons to fear domestic violence. Then the triggering event of the filing for divorce can be a very, very scary time for good reason. I'm concerned that not only has the lower courts interpreted the meaning of threat far too narrowly, they have also made statements about the alleged lack of fear by the plaintiff in a way that doesn't really make sense, not only on the facts, but I believe that what is most significant is not whether or not there is actual expressed fear, subjective fear, but whether there is reason for there to be fear. Many times domestic violence victims are so numbed and so paralyzed and desensitized by the ongoing nature of the breaking of furniture, the breaking down of doors, et cetera, that their ability to express fear is very much diminished. I think that courts, therefore, it is those courts who consider domestic violence petitions' job to look at the reasons that objectively give reason for there to be fear. Again, I think it's important for this court's opinion to stress that domestic violence can only be proven and prevented if it is considered within a context. And that full context was clearly prevented in this case.
Thank you, Ms. Hines. The appellee has not filed a brief. As we have oral argument, the case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.